Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkook. Although Kilauea's volcanic activity has paused at all 15 fissures, there are growing concerns about the ongoing eruption. Officials are looking at hazardous fumes and the risk of explosions in the area. HPR News Director Bill Dorman has been monitoring the latest news from the Pahoa area, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Bill.
Yeah, good morning, Chris. So a lot of this is, Derek was mentioning just in the newscast about, for example, the most of Hawaii's Volcanoes National Park is going to be closed on Friday.
Right.
And it's that concern. Again, you have the rift zone, but you have miles away the summit itself. And
yeah.
Now the focus on this is the dropping levels of lava in the lava lake inside. And as those come to the water table, the steam explosions that can
it's going to push outward, and something's got to give.
Right? And this is, again, you know, on so much of this, there's so much uncertainty in terms of exactly what would happen and what is possible. And so a lot of the geologists involved in this talk about the realm of possibility. Don Swanson is with USGS. He was on that call yesterday, breaking down in terms of what happens as the lava reaches that water table, those steam explosions go. So within half a mile of the crater itself, you're looking at boulders perhaps as much as 10 or 12 tons coming out, being expelled by
the
air. Exactly. And then for several miles, in his terms, it could be marble-sized rocks and ash going out. And then, again, you have this sort of circles going out further from that. 10 to 20 miles downwind, you have that fine ash.
Yeah.
And, again, of course, this depends on wind direction and all that. But,
right.
Again, he had the geologists yesterday were talking in terms of perhaps at some point next week, based on sort of the drainage flow. Volcanoes Park clearly stepped up in terms of the timing of precautionary.
Sure.
And they said that due to the receding lava lake and ensuing ashfall event, plus southerly wind patterns forecasted for Friday. So that plays a factor in all of this as well.
Yeah, there's been. I saw a report that the winds are expected to die down and are shift over the weekend, and that's an air quality challenge in and of itself, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the other concern of, as you know, as these fissures erupt and you have the concentration of the gas going off on the sulfur dioxide, and that's an ongoing safety concern as well.
What other things are they looking at in the area, civil defense officials? What are their primary areas?
Well, I tell you, it's a big thing in terms of the Puna geothermal moving the gas.
Yeah, that seems to have been moved away, right?
Yes, and that was done by 3 in the morning today. It's, again, 60,000 gallons of pentane, and that, again, from now, we'll see where this goes. Concern not just in terms of the rift zone, but also at the crater as well.
Bill, thanks very much for checking in with us. We're going to hear more from you. You're going to be getting a telephone briefing, and we're going to check in with you at the end of the show.
You bet.
Thanks for that. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director, and we'll check in with him again at the end of the broadcast.
Governor David Ige took emergency measures yesterday to secure the plant operated by Puna Geothermal Venture. That facility is located in the vicinity of Leilani Estates, just outside the epicenter of the ongoing eruption event. And as Bill mentioned, that Ige said that the facility is currently safe, but local residents expressed their growing fears at a recent community meeting.
I would like to emphasize that the facility today is safe. As part of our emergency procedures, the facility has been shut down, but we want to be certain that we have the authority to act decisively if necessary.
The facility has been home to 60,000 gallons of the flammable chemical called pentane. Some worry that could contribute to a massive blowout at one of PGV's geothermal wells.
The fissures have been opening up along that track, and if you project the track of the line of where the fissures are occurring, the PGV facility is on that line. We want to mitigate the risk of the pentane fluid as soon as possible, because that clearly is something that if we move it offsite, we can take action proactively. The issue with the wellheads are different because we can't move those.
Now, PGV did initially move to relocate the pentane elsewhere on its property, but government officials felt that given the unpredictability of the lava flow, it might be prudent to get that fuel off-site. And as Bill mentioned, that was completed as of 3 this morning.
Certainly, we had had that discussion with PGV, and we asked them to act as quickly as possible. The reason that I took this action is because we were not satisfied that they were acting quickly enough.
The governor's supplemental proclamation allows him to take action regarding private facilities in the interest of public safety. He hopes it will not come to that.
Clearly, we would want to work with PGV, and they will be part of this team. But we want to be certain that we have the authority to take whatever action is required to mitigate the risk to the community.
And for the latest updates on the Kilauea eruption, visit hawaiipublicradio.org. It's been a year since Honolulu City Council members deferred a bill to require regular building inspections, but the issue hasn't gone away, particularly with so many aging residential buildings across Oahu. Honolulu City Councilman Trevor Ozawa introduced Bill 17 after a rusted railing ended the life of one man and critically injured a second at the Ala Moana Shopping Center. But the bill has come up against stiff opposition and hasn't advanced. The issue is back in the spotlight as a lawsuit has now been filed against General Growth Properties on behalf of the families of the two men involved in the fall at the popular shopping mall. The incident is a wake-up call for property owners when it comes to public safety. Here's attorney Rick Freed.
People have to be cognizant of their responsibilities to the public. I mean, this is horrific. This is kind of Hawaii's gathering place, Ala Moana. Everyone goes there, locals, tourists, and you shouldn't have to be the least bit concerned about using the facility, you know, leaning something as simple as leaning against a rail. So owners of properties need to do proper inspections, and here they had been beaten over the head about it. You know, they were told exactly what needed to do. There was a circle, fix these railings. Who knows why they didn't.
And just last month, two other men fell from a two-story walk-up in Kalihi when the balcony collapsed. The city has cited the property owner for those unsafe conditions. The Department of Planning and Permitting testified against Bill 17, saying it lacked the staff to enforce any new requirements. Many condo owners opposed the mandatory inspection, citing costs at a time when the city was pushing for mandatory sprinklers in residential high-rises. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Hawaii prepares for medical aid in dying as the law of the land. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're visiting a historic home that sits on a large unsubdivided parcel running from Kalaniana Ole Highway to the ocean. Built in 1936, the house is one of the first lures and cook homes built along Oahu's southeastern shores. The high-pitched roof, extended eaves, and lanai, along with elements of a French farmhouse, make this a great example of the craftsman's style of architect Raymond Llewellyn Morris. Fans of the new Hawaii Five-O recognize the property as the television residence of Steve McGarrett. Designed to sit on a 5-foot-thick foundation, the home is anchored with steel bolts. that allowed it to survive tidal waves in the area. One of the worst was in 1946, when tsunami waves hit the coastal property. The original owner's son says that the family just opened all the doors and windows to let the waves roll right on through the house. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this property listed on the State Register of Historic Places? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Drew from Paradise Cove. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Medical aid in dying becomes law in Hawaii on January 1st. Designated as the Our Care, Our Choice Act. Opponents fought hard against it, and for Kat West, National Director of Policy and Programs for Compassion and Choices Hawaii, the passage of the bill is only the beginning of a public education program.
Medical aid in dying will go into effect on January 1st, 2019. Mm-hmm. So we have about 8 months to get ready for a successful implementation, because we know that on January 1st, there will be terminally ill people asking their doctors for a prescription for medical aid in dying. And we want to make sure that we have successfully implemented the law so that these people aren't disappointed and they're asking because they really need it. And so we need to educate communities so they understand their rights under the law, and we need to educate providers so that they're able to honor their patients' wishes.
What does the law state?
Sure. So medical aid in dying says that only eligible people are able to make a request for a prescription. A person must be an adult. They must be terminally ill. They must have a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. And they must be mentally capable of making their own health care decisions. And if two doctors certify that a person is eligible, then they have to go through a process. They need to make two oral requests, they need to make a written request, and then they are able to obtain a prescription for medical aid in dying that they can choose to take if their suffering becomes unbearable.
I would think that in the discussions leading up to the passage of this bill that the phrase capable of making the decision was one that hit a snag. I mean, who decides that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there was a lot of discussion around it. Luckily, the answer is pretty simple. Every day, doctors make these decisions. In fact, doctors are expert at deciding whether somebody is mentally capable of mm-hmm. making healthcare decisions. They have to be, because they have to get informed consent for mm-hmm. any medical treatment or procedure. Mm-hmm. So every day, for small matters and for matters that are life and death, they are making these decisions.
The new legislation has sometimes been characterized as assisted suicide. What are your objections to that term?
Well, language is important. Language matters. And when opponents, people who don't believe that anybody should have this option, when they use language like that, it's deliberately hurtful, it's deliberately harmful, and it's offensive. It's offensive to dying patients who desperately want to live, but they have a disease that's not going to allow that. And so these patients, they just want to have this option. They want to have the prescription on file with a pharmacy, so if their pain or their suffering becomes unbearable, they can shorten what would otherwise be a really prolonged suffering experience. And so it is really painful for patients and their families to have it characterized as anything other than medical aid in dying.
in the course of advancing this bill, you've heard a great many arguments against it. What kind of arguments did you hear, and how did you respond to them?
Sure. Well, the two main arguments that we heard in Hawaii, the first was religious, moral objection,
mm-hmm.
And you know how we always respond and how our supporters respond is, that's fine. If you have a specific moral objection to medical aid and dying, then by, you know what, don't choose it. By no means is this anything other than voluntary.
Mm-hmm.
But don't force your own morals on other people. Other people don't necessarily believe that suffering is redemptive and suffering is a good thing. So everyone should be allowed to make their own choices. The second argument that we heard was that vulnerable populations would be coerced. That's what we were. That's what opponents said. They would be coerced into taking the medication. And we were very clear that that is not what the facts show. That's not what the evidence shows. 20 years of experience in Oregon, there has never been a single, not one single instance of any coercion or abuse. In fact, Disability Rights Oregon, which is the advocate for the disabled community in Oregon, has testified that they have never received a complaint from any of their members in Oregon in 20 years. The process to get a prescription is actually quite long, quite complicated, and there's so many core safeguards in place that it is virtually impossible for someone to be coerced. And so it has never happened in the combined 40 years of experience across all the authorized states.
In going back to that first set of objections that you cited, you sort of got an idea that's kind of at the center maybe of our Puritan ethic in America, that we are redeemed by suffering. Is that sort of a bedrock notion of opponents to this bill?
Yeah, sadly, it is. Every time that medical aid in dying is introduced into legislation, in fact, this year, I think there were 23 states that introduced legislation around medical aid in dying, opponents always come out and try to make the argument that suffering is good, and people who want to avoid suffering are somehow, are somehow weak. Yeah, that's great. And you know, I don't buy that. I don't think most people buy that. What I would say to that person is, okay, the next time you go to a dentist, don't take Novocaine. You know, like if there's no reason why people should have to suffer. What we should be doing as a society is being compassionate, not trying to make people suffer.
I'm guessing that your volunteer group and others has gathered a great deal of testimony from people who are in this situation, who are candidates for medical aid in dying.
Yeah. We work with dying patients. We work with their families. They reach out to us for support, and it's by far the best part of what we do is providing these families support, and they are so grateful when a state passes a law. And in Hawaii, I just want to call out one particular person that we're working with, John Radcliffe. And he's been, you know, in the media, he's been
sure.
in the news. And he and his family are very grateful to the residents of Hawaii and to the courage of the legislators and to the governor for making this option available.
He's really been a tireless advocate, hasn't he?
He's amazing. And, you know, he has limited energy and he has limited time. And, of course, he's spending a lot of that with his family, but he's also spending a lot of it making sure that this law is going to be available to other terminally ill people as well.
What's the place of the family in this decision? Suppose you want to bring this about and your family does not. What kind of weight is given to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, what I can tell you is that most people who make a request for medical aid in dying bring their family into the discussion and the decision. They often bring their spiritual advisors
mm-hmm.
into the discussion as well as their medical team. And people who do obtain a prescription often have the most touching and heartfelt going away ceremonies if they choose to take the prescription. Not everyone does. Mm-hmm. About a third of people don't actually end up taking the medication because their suffering never becomes unbearable. Mm-hmm. But the ones that do have these amazing going away parties. And it is a party. It's a celebration of their family and their friends. But in the rare instance where a family, maybe they're you know, religiously based and they wouldn't agree, the patient does not have to get the permission of anyone, mm-hmm. including their family. This is all about patient autonomy and, you know, patients should be able to make healthcare decisions on their own. So if a patient chose not to tell their family because their family would object, that's okay, and that's what the law states.
The whole subject of dying is this kind of subject that seems to derail everyone who comes into contact with it. It's the big unknown, isn't it?
Yeah. Americans, our culture, does not deal with death and dying very well.
You think more so in American culture than in others?
Well, I think it's different across cultures, but some cultures are much more comfortable with the notions of the cycle of life. You know, it's interesting. When I do some presentations across the community, I will sometimes ask, how many people know that they're going to die in this room? And it takes a while for everyone to put their hands up, believe it or not. It's just something that I think...
We push away from our consciousness, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, I understand it, but it's a reality. And having this option for people who are in that situation where they have 6 months or less to live, it's a blessing for them.
Kat West is the National Director of Policy and Programs for Compassion and Choices Hawaii. The Our Care, Our Choice Act goes into effect on January 1st, 2019. You can learn more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Philippe Bianconi performing Schumann's Piano Concerto with Naoto Otomo conducting this Sunday at the Blaisdell, hisymphony.org.
We've been hearing a lot about vacation rentals, but the issue takes a different turn in light of the recent floods on Kauai. That's the subject of our reality check from our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Brittany Light is on the line. Morning, Brittany.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Catherine.
I thought that was a really interesting story that you reported on. I mean, tell us more about these restrictions that are in place.
Yeah, it's a tricky issue. So a few years back, the county prohibited vacation rentals from operating in some of these farthest reaches of Kauai's North Shore, where there's only one evacuation route if there's a flash flood or tsunami, because they were concerned about the safety of tourists who might be staying in these rentals if a disaster were to occur. How would they get out? The problem is there's a state law that prohibits counties from phasing out these vacation rental uses if they've already been in play. So a grandfather clause allows more than 200 of them to continue to operate. So really the county's prohibition is more symbolic. And so now, in light of this flood, Kauai's mayor has put a stop on these vacation rentals, just temporarily, across the board, though, until the end of May. And that's because this area simply isn't open to the public yet. Only residents are being allowed in, and only on a very limited basis because the road is in such tough shape.
So what are they doing? Are they checking IDs, or do you have to have a special pass to get through?
Exactly. You have to have a special pass to get in. There's sort of a caravan that takes you in certain times of day, and you've got to sign up, really. So it's still a really perilous situation out there. The road is still unstable in some places. And until it's open fully to the public, which might not be till later this summer, I don't know that we'll be seeing these vacation rentals back in operation.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you booked online, one of these online operators, Airbnb or HomeAway, how do you know, where to go or getting the information straight from those operators?
Exactly. I think these operators are experiencing a flood, no pun intended, of phone calls from people who are just really concerned. Even folks who are staying in parts of the island that are unaffected, that are still open for business and still beautiful places to visit. These people are really concerned about coming to the island because they know that certain pockets have experienced such, dramatic damage and that they wonder if it's rude to have their vacation, right next to people who are really dealing with disaster.
Right. And I love the pictures that Anthony Quintana took, with the tourists on the beach with their luggage waiting to get hauled out of there in the early days of that flooding. Just remarkable.
Yeah, I agree. Most vacationers who were out there during the flood did evacuate. They jumped on a helicopter. They were allowed to take one piece of luggage with them. So folks who had more luggage than that had to leave it behind. And then the realty agents were left to sort of pack people's things up, put them in garbage bags, get them on these little boats that volunteers were operating, and get them to the other side of the road closure. So it really was a mess. Luckily, in this case, everybody is safe. Nobody was badly injured. But the next time a disaster like this strikes, it could be a different situation. So I think the county wants to just make sure that vacationers know what they're signing up for when they're staying in some of these really remote places that are, in a flood zone.
Right. And I can see for folks who are against vacation rentals because of the potential impact on the housing, maybe using this as another reason why they don't want those vacation rentals, or so many of them anyway.
Exactly. I mean, Kauai is no different than the rest of the state. Housing is really hard to come by, and these vacation rentals, make money, but they definitely limit the local housing supply.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Brittany.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Brittany Light with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Each week, Says You, Public Radio's game of words and wit, attempts to present a seamless professional presentation with varying results.
Where are the words?
The words are downstairs.
This is not helpful.
This is an embarrassing moment.
Perhaps you can tell them when these shows will air. And then you won't have to do that.
A teaching moment.
Yes, a teaching moment. And I really don't know when these shows will air.
Thursday evenings at 6:30.
The Daniel K. Inouye Solar Telescope under construction on the summit of Haleakala is said to be on track for opening next year. DKIST, as scientists call it, is the largest solar telescope ever built. For an explanation of the science going on at the facility, our producer Ryan Finnerty spoke with solar astronomer Tom Shad as they toured the seven-story telescope.
DKIST is really taking leaps and bounds for solar physics and solar astronomy. So this telescope in particular, we're looking at just the sun. We're concentrating on the sun itself. And by leaps and bounds, I mean this is the world's largest solar telescope once it's operational. And some concept of what it means to be the world's largest solar telescope, we can look at what used to be the Haleakala solar telescope, which is this small dome down here on the right. That's the size of a dome using very small mirrors, small lenses, of the size maybe, a foot or two across. And all of a sudden, you can see the big change or the contrast to DKIST, which has a 4-meter mirror that collects some 100 times more light than something like this.
How much larger is the new telescope than what's currently here?
Well, so the world's largest solar telescope right now is in Big Bear, California, and it's a mirror that's 1.6 meters across. And this one here has a mirror that's 4 meters across. So that's about a factor of 10 or more in terms of total area. And that's really what counts. The total area is what determines how much light you collect from the sun. And a lot of people don't necessarily appreciate that even though the sun is very, very bright, we actually need big mirrors to collect as much light as we can because we're looking at the detail at such small scales and over small pieces of the solar electromagnetic spectrum that every single little piece of light that we can observe, every photon from the sun, is precious to us because it gives us greater and more accurate measurements of what's going on the surface of the sun, and that's really what we care about.
So you'll be looking at our sun, not stars in other solar systems.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the, I mean, the sun is the Rosetta Stone of astronomy, as we call it. It is that what we use to understand how atoms form different pieces of the electromagnetic spectrum, how spectral lines give us information about the gas variables, the temperatures, the pressures, the densities. Only the sun is where we can study that in such great resolution. And what we learn there, we can then apply to the other stars and other suns and other solar systems.
And why build this telescope on Haleakala?
There's multiple reasons, but there's two main ones. One, and a lot of it goes back to measurements that we made during what's called the survey period for telescopes. Back, I think it was 2002 to 2004. We surveyed a number of sites across the globe. And what we're really looking for is two things. We're looking for a site that is very clear. It has a lot of sunshine hours and very clear skies. And the other thing is that it is not, those skies are not disturbed by turbulence that is built up during the day. So just as, you know, if you're driving along a desert highway in Arizona, you look across the road and all of a sudden you see the turbulent atmosphere above the road breaking up the image. Mm-hmm. We want to find a site that doesn't give us that problem because we want pristine images. So we come to a place like Haleakala, and it's amazing because we have a nice wind flow over the mountain and nice cool air coming up that actually keeps the air clean, but it also keeps the air laminar and smooth, and that eliminates much of that turbulence. So it's one of the best sites in the world in order to keep to look at the little bitty details of the sun.
Is there a difference between Haleakala and Mauna Kea? There are a lot of telescopes over on the Big Island. What makes this site ideal for this type of telescope?
That's an interesting question. I don't have a lot of experience with it, but what I've been told is the geological history of Mauna Kea and Haleakala are very different. So the dust environment is very different. So Mauna Kea might have more dust, per se, than Haleakala. And dust, for us, is a major impact when we're looking at the solar corona, which is one of the very dim, faint things that are around, a faint structure around the sun itself. And that dust can have an impact on our imaging quality. However, the other thing is actually, there's really big differences between the imaging quality during the day and that during the night. And it turns out, from what I've heard, that actually the imaging quality during the day is better here on Haleakala than it is on Mauna Kea.
And so that's maybe counterintuitive, but because this is a solar telescope, you're actually operating during the daytime rather than the nighttime like most other telescopes.
Exactly, yeah, that's the key difference.
And when do you expect to go operational with this telescope?
So at the moment right now, we're putting in the major pieces of the optics, and the instruments are coming along in their fabrication, and they'll go in next year. And then we hope to really start serving the science community and producing data early 2020.
And what will some of the first pieces of data you'll be collecting? What types of unknown phenomena are you hoping to study initially?
Well, so we're interested in a very diverse set of phenomena on the sun. But actually right now, the sun is going through what is called the solar minimum. So the sun has a cycle. It has about 11-year on average cycle, where sometimes it has many sunspots, or these very strongly intense magnetic field regions on the sun. And then it goes through periods where that doesn't exist. And right now we're entering in that period where there's no sunspot. So the features that we're interested in right away are very tiny, small, what we call granules, or features of the convection, of the boiling pot on the surface of the sun. So when we first turn this thing on, this DKIST, and we have some of the highest resolution images that the world has ever seen of the sun, what we're looking for is what detail is at that small scale. And because in part, that detail is what is going to tell us exactly what creates the magnetic field on the sun. So in part, those images will help us test whether the models that we've been creating over the last decade are anywhere close to being correct. But there's also just the fun aspect of being able to see the sun at a detail that nobody's ever seen before.
Anything else you'd like people to know about the project?
Lots. Let's take a look. We'll show you more as we go.
The exterior of DKIST is largely complete, but significant work is still taking place under the dome. After climbing several flights of stairs, we're standing in the main laboratory that will house 5 custom-built instruments. The entire room can rotate to allow each instrument to collect light as the sun moves throughout the day.
This is the Coudé lab, but this is really the heart of DKIST in a way, because this is where all of the science gets done. The 5 instruments that are going to be placed on this platform are really going to fill this volume in a way that you maybe can't imagine. Right now it's empty. It's an empty laboratory. But once we bring in all the equipment, it's going to be very full. What's really powerful about this telescope is that each one of those instruments shares the light. So as you asked, the light comes down from above, but we are able to split that light in different ways. So one instrument that might look at the visible light and one instrument that might look at the infrared light can do that at the same time. And that really empowers our science, because different pieces of light tell you about different layers of the sun. So what we're really trying to do is 3D imaging of the sun by using the light in special ways.
Next, we go to the upper level of the telescope, inside the iconic dome that can be seen from the outside. The dome is several stories high and houses 7 mirrors that will direct sunlight into the lab below. But with all that focused light comes heat, and that is a problem.
In front of us, of course, we have the very large telescope mount assembly where the telescope actually sets the prime mirror. But around us is the enclosure, or the shelter for the telescope.
The dome part that everyone sees.
Right. And in the dome, you can see these mechanical louvers, or windows, that can be opened. So we have all of these louvers that allow wind to passively cool our systems inside. Mm-hmm. But then actually on the external part of the enclosure, we also have plate coils that actively cool the entire enclosure using cooled water that's created from a facility just outside of here. And that's all in service of creating a perfect image.
So managing temperature is a huge part of this project.
Enormous. It's a telescope in part and a refrigerator in another.
That was producer Ryan Finnerty talking to solar astronomer Tom Shad. The solar telescope is currently on schedule to begin producing images of the sun at the beginning of 2019. That data will help scientists continue unraveling the mysteries of the universe beyond our planet. For more information, visit the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Georgia Skinner from Creative Industries DBED. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we asked you about a historic home designed by architect Raymond Llewellyn Morris and built in the Wailupi'ili subdivision in 1936. Fans of the new Hawaii 5-0 recognize this property as the television residence of Steve McGarrett. Thoughtfully designed to sit on a 5-foot-thick foundation, the home is anchored with steel bolts, allowing the property to sustain minimal damage from severe tidal waves. One of the worst was in 1946, when tsunami waves hit the coastal property. Walter Baer shared the story of how his family just opened all the doors and windows to let the waves roll right on through the house. Unlike their neighbor's home, which washed off its foundation and ended up on the 2-lane old government road, now known as the Kalanianiole Highway. Fortunately for TV fans and historic preservationists alike, current owners Richard and Suze Mirkitani welcome visitors to tour the graceful Hawaiian-style house known as the Carl and Florence Baer Residence in Haina Haina.
And Catherine Kamana Seymour of Honolulu was the first to get that right. Congratulations, you're our backyard quiz winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Some of the most highly skilled musicians in Hawaii are members of its military bands, and once a year, Hawaii-based bands from the Air Force, the Marine Corps, Army, and Navy combine for a free concert. Tech Sergeant Ryan Leatherman is the public information officer and an ensemble member for the United States Air Force Band of the Pacific. He told us about plans for the show.
The theme is Letters from Home, mm-hmm. and the idea is to talk about the connection that military members stationed overseas and deployed in a variety of situations have with their family members. Mm-hmm. So we're going to take a look at a variety of media that have been used to keep in touch over that time, whether it's letters, radio, television, and in more modern times, Skype and the internet. Just trying to focus on how it is that the military member stays in touch with their family and maintains that vital connection during some of the difficult missions that they're a part of.
And then given that this is a joint concert, this being something that is shared by all members of all the different services.
Absolutely, and we're going to showcase that on stage as well. We've got members of all five military bands on Oahu that'll be a part of that with us. The Hawaii Army National Guard Band, the 25th Infantry Division Army Band, the Marine Corps Forces Pacific Band, the United States Pacific Fleet Band, and then I'm a member of the United States Air Force Band of the Pacific. So you'll see that joint interoperability that is a hallmark of today's military showcased on stage as well.
Each of them has a mission, basically to perform at for the public as well as for military events, right?
That's right, sir. This is a full-time job for those of us that are on active duty in those bands. Mm-hmm. This is the main focus of what we do, mm-hmm. is to perform music, and we become, in a lot of ways, the face of the military to the public. So we'll, in addition to supporting military ceremonies and a lot of on-base events, we'll be out and about trying to connect with the community as well.
I've seen audiences be somewhat surprised to hear a military band at a public event, you know, bust out some rock and roll or some jazz, but you're expected to be pretty versatile, aren't you?
Absolutely, we are. I know in the Air Force Band, I'm personally a saxophone player, and so I'm expected to be able to sit in a concert band, play in a big band and play jazz, get up with a pop band and play that style of music as well, sometimes some classical chamber music. We really end up wearing a lot of different hats in the military.
What kind of daily routine does that make for you?
So really, I can certainly speak about our band, the Air Force Band of the Pacific. We're really a self-contained music business, mm-hmm. in that since our mission is to get out and to perform music, for us in the Indo-Pacific region, so that takes us all around the Pacific. All of the things that need to happen in-house to get us out on the road, whether it's here on Oahu or traveling to other countries or other parts of the United States, those are the things that we're doing every day. So it's obviously practicing music, but then sometimes writing and arranging music and making sure that product is put together. We do have some messaging that we put together and marketing materials. Mm-hmm. We have to schedule the performances and then work out all of the logistics. We've got folks that are booking travel and lodging and some of those things for us as well. And then since we are active duty members of the military, we have all of those military requirements as well. So fitness, safety, all sorts of training that we have to do to make sure that we're up on the military side of things as well as music. Mm-hmm.
Fitness in particular is quite relevant to the life of a musician, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, for me as a wind player, you know, having the lung capacity built up and making sure I'm in shape to be able to play is very important. And that goes for, you know, every instrument in the band as well. Not only that, but we want to present a strong image of the military in terms of fitness, because that's one of the hallmarks of the military, and that's one of the things that we try to make sure is a part of our appearance when we're out on stage as well.
For you as a musician, has it been a good life, good training for a musical future?
Absolutely. I came in, actually, I was a graduate student before I joined the Air Force Band. I had a wife and I had two kids and was getting ready to look for a job, and lo and behold, something came open with the Air Force Band of the West in Texas, and won an audition there with them, and that's been a great way to utilize the musical skills that I learned prior to getting into the military and then to serve my country at the same time. So it's a very rewarding experience.
Are you expected to continue to hone those musical skills?
Absolutely. The idea is to maintain and even improve that skill level as we go along.
Does that get tested?
It does. We've got what they call upgrade training that happens at a couple of different points during our careers. But the real test is every day when you sit down to play your instrument, because I'm surrounded by great musicians, and that presses me to want to maintain and even improve and advance my skill level to be able to match them. And it really helps us to put out the best product that we can going for out on stage. And by doing that, represent the excellence that is in everything that the United States Air Force does.
You know, so many musicians on the civilian side who kind of get into it because they love to play their instrument find themselves, you know, hitting snags on the business end or some aspect of the music life that they perhaps had not anticipated. It sounds as if you folks are sort of heading off those possibilities by dealing with all the aspects of the musician's life.
Right, and the military really helps to provide some opportunities that you wouldn't get on the outside of, you know, in the civilian world as a musician, too. It takes a lot of planning, a lot of communication to make sure that we're set together, and then we'll have a week's worth of rehearsals prior to presenting our program on May 19th in the Hawaii Theater. Mm-hmm. And so we'll sort of mix and match, take members of each of the bands and put them together into a concert band, into a big band, into a rock band, and we'll have all of those different teams as a part of the show there.
Tech Sergeant Ryan Leatherman plays saxophone with the United States Air Force Band of the Pacific and serves as its public information officer. He'll be part of the 33rd annual joint military concert at the Hawaii Theater, Saturday, May 19th at 4 p.m. Admission is free, feature a joint performance by members of the Army 25th Infantry Division Band, the Hawaii Army National Guard Band, the Marine Corps Forces Pacific Band, the Navy U.S. Pacific Fleet Band, and the Air Force Band of the Pacific. Details are on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Before we wrap up for the day, HPR News Director Bill Dorman joins us in the studio for a final check on the latest information on the Kilauea eruption.
Yes, so not a lot of new information coming out right now, but still looking at what we've been looking at, the question in terms of the crater itself and that buildup of steam, where that may happen in terms of the declining lava in the lake down to the water table. But also just an opportunity really to look at something that you'd mentioned earlier in terms of the governor and this idea of disaster declaration and that you have to hit a certain threshold of damages, mm-hmm. around $2 million for federal aid. And the way that works in tracking, you know, within all of the news of the volcano, little news that got buried this week is that President Trump did approve the major disaster declaration for Hawaii back on the Kauai and Oahu flooding.
Yeah.
And that just came out on Tuesday. So that took a little over 3 weeks in terms of from the event itself. So, again, just looking ahead in terms of expectations of that aid coming, something that's not an immediate factor but still is in play now.
It frequently seems sort of murky what those qualifications are for a disaster declaration because you usually it's very obvious to you on the scene that it's a disaster. But it takes a while for that federal mandate to kick in.
And it's interesting in terms of when Governor Ige was making the case, saying that, for example, the impassability of roads is a huge one, and cracks in roads and things like that in terms of going to infrastructure as well. But that is true.
And I believe in East Honolulu they've had a representative from the National Flood Insurance Program. I think they're being available to kind of answer questions that people might have from East Honolulu about the flood program.
Yeah, exactly. And what is eligible and what is not, and different groups as well. It's the federal funding goes to state, local governments, certain private nonprofit organizations. There's a lot of cost sharing on that as well.
It's interesting, Bill, that the focus has shifted to Hale Mau Mau, some 30 miles, but from the Pahoa area. And, you know, visitors to Volcanoes National Park have seen it, have a picture of what Hale Mau Mau looks like. It looks very different today, doesn't it?
Well, and just that idea of potential, explosive nature of what they're talking about. And talking to Dave Lawrence just a little bit ago in terms of the unusual nature of closing most of Volcanoes National Park. That's not something that they do lightly. That's coming tomorrow. And Chris, you had mentioned earlier in terms of the wind as well. Today, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory confirming volcanic activity pausing at all 15 fissures, but noting that hazardous fumes continue to be released due to a forecast of decreasing trade winds. Residents advised to monitor their sensitivity to increased levels of sulfur dioxide in the latter part of this week.
The first things you would notice would be things like burning eyes, if you're in the presence of sulfur dioxide. But with the wind dying down, it means it could kind of settle down over the area.
Exactly, and that's the concern in terms of, those with respiratory ailments to start with as well and vulnerability.
It seems as if there are going to be new things to look at every day with this story. It's really a...
Try to keep up with it.
Exactly. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 11 a.m.
Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line. Leave us your comments. The number to do that is 808-792-8217.
And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and on Twitter at HI Conversation.
If you missed this show, a section of it, or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about our guests and topics. Look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.